Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we will have part three of our four-year anniversary. I told you guys I was going to go through all these over 200 shows that we've done over the last 4 years and gotten some of my favorite clips. So today will be our final installment of our four-year anniversary. It took three episodes to do it. So I hope you guys have enjoyed it. And today we'll be hearing from the late Peter McGough. We'll also be having a couple clips from Jerry Branum. Jerry has probably been on the show more than anybody. We always do our end of the year wrap-ups with Jerry. And then Jerry's just been on many, many times. So we got a couple clips from Jerry. Ellington Darden will be another one that we're going to have on the show. Mark Martinez and Boyer Co., of course, another one of my favorites. And we're also going to have Tom Terwilliger and Joey Folco. So that's what we got coming up on part three of our four-year anniversary. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. So what's going on in your world, guys? At the end of our podcast today, I will be reading another article from an old muscle builder magazine. Last week, we read an article about Arnold from 1977. It was written by Rick Wayne. This one is exactly 1 year later, and this will be from 1978, where Rick again interviews Arnold. And the title of the article is I Am Grateful to Joe Weider by Rick Wayne, and it's about Arnold, of course. And what I really thought was interesting about this article was they talk in depth about that bodybuilders union that was supposed to be put together in 1978 by Cal Scalak. And I was looking through, when I got these magazines a couple of months ago from my parents' house, I was looking for that article about the union. And there was one article I found, but it really didn't go into too much depth. And I was thinking I missed something. Well, I think it was from this article that they really gave the information about the union. So I think you guys will really enjoy this article if you're interested in what happened with that bodybuilders union. So I will be reading that as soon as our clips are over. All right, we got some bad news. Last week, the fabled physique photographer Jimmy Caruso passed away at 95 years old. He died on July 18th. And Jimmy was another one of these guys I was trying to get on the show, but I just didn't have any contact information for him. There was a gym in Montreal that, of course, Jimmy ran for many, many years. And, of course, he was a coach as well as a photographer. And I heard rumors that he was still coaching people there. I was trying to get a hold of him. I was trying to get a hold of that gym. And I just didn't have any success. And now, unfortunately, Jimmy has passed away at the old age of 95 years old. So he lived a very long life. I guess he was just short of his 96th birthday. He was only like a couple weeks away from his 96th birthday. So, of course, Jimmy was the one who took these great photographs for Muscle Builder Magazine and Joe Weider. All those studio shots that we've seen of Arnold and Frank Zane and all the greats from the 70s particularly, Jimmy was the one that took them. He was a master photographer, and I think a lot of photographers who came up after him learned a lot from Jimmy. Jimmy was also a great bodybuilding coach, and he was responsible for getting Roy Callender back into the bodybuilding scene Roy used to compete in the NABBA universe back in the 60s. In fact, he was in Arnold's first NABBA universe win in 1967. And then he stopped competing and he was doing pro wrestling. And it was Jimmy that got him back into bodybuilding. He said, Roy, you need to get into bodybuilding. You're wasting your talent. You're wasting your time. And so Roy came back in 1977. He started off by winning the Canadian championships. And then he went on to the Mr. International, which was held with the Olympia that year. And he won the heavyweight class, but he lost the overall to Mohamed McAway. And then Roy went to the Mr. Universe contest in Nîmes, France, and he won the middleweight division, beating out Darcy Beckles. And then he started his great pro career, where he took third place in his first Mr. Olympia in 1978. He won the Canada Cup, and he won many other pro shows. And finally, I think he reached his peak at the 1981 Olympia, where he got fifth place, a very controversial fifth place because he was so ripped in that contest. So we've had Roy on our bodybuilding podcast a couple of times. He's a joy to talk to. And I know he gives a lot of credit to Jimmy Caruso for helping him with his career. So rest in peace to the great photographer, Jimmy Caruso, one of the greatest photographers the bodybuilding world has ever seen. And I'm very sad that I didn't get a chance to talk to Jimmy, but this happened so much on this show. There's so many guys I want to talk to. I never got a chance to talk to Ed Corney before he passed. And Franco, of course, nobody expected him to pass away so soon. It's hard to get a hold of a lot of these guys, and a lot of these old-timing guys, they don't want to do interviews. So it's difficult, but I just keep trying. That's all I can do. And some brighter news, Lee Labrada's son, Hunter Labrada, who is now proving himself to be one of the top pro bodybuilders in the world, just won his second pro show last weekend, and that was the Chicago Pro Show, which was actually held in Atlanta because they're still having problems with COVID. And Hunter last year won the Tampa Pro, which was his first pro show. So just like his father, who won his first pro show, the Night of the Champions in 1986, Hunter Labrada won his first pro show last year when he went into the Tampa Pro. And then he went to the Olympia last year. He got eighth. So now he is going back to the Olympia because he won again, and he is qualified now for the 2021 Olympia. And I believe Hunter is about 29 years old, and he should do probably better, maybe in the top six this year. His physique is getting better. He is much bigger than he was last year. Very balanced physique. He's got a lot of similarities to his dad. And I heard his posing routine was also really good. I think you guys heard me mention a couple of weeks ago that I got to interview Hunter and Lee Labrada on stage at the Europa Orlando Expo, which was held about 3 weeks ago. And that was a real fun time doing that. I had a great time doing it. And I had a feeling Hunter was going to pull it off, even though he was going up against Rolly Winkler, who was one of the biggest super freaks in bodybuilding. But Rolly was off, and he only took fifth. And Hunter wins again. So Hunter's career is progressing very nicely. He reminds me of his dad, where he's very analytical. He's very plans everything out. He's not an emotional guy at all. He doesn't freak out or miss his peak. He's got everything planned. He's very organized and very intelligent. And he told me at that seminar that he's going to do the same as his dad. He's only going to be a pro bodybuilder for 10 years, and he will retire by the age of 35, just like his dad did. So we've only got about six more years to watch Hunter Labrada on the pro scene. So he says if he hasn't won the Olympia by then, he's probably never going to. So he's not going to sacrifice his health, and he wants to have life after bodybuilding. So good for him. All right, so I think that's all I got. I did not get any emails from you guys last week. I don't know if you're enjoying the shows we're doing, these anniversary shows or not, but I did not get any emails. Didn't post any videos on YouTube. Well, actually, I did post a couple. I posted the 1989 Mr. Olympia pose down on my YouTube channel, and I also posted a clip of the Phil Williams, Tony Pearson interview where they talked about some stories with George Turner, but I didn't get any emails from last week's show, so we will get right to it, guys. Here is part three of our four-year anniversary for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, we're going to start off with a late Peter McGough. Peter was a friend of mine and passed away late last year, from cancer, which he was bravely battling for many, many years. I'm fortunate that I got to interview Peter for our podcast several times. I think we did at least three or four interviews. I know I did one with him and Lonnie Tieper together, and I did one with him and Wayne Galash together. And then I did one with him last spring, which was Peter's last interview. That was spring of 2020, because he died at the end of the year. And then I think there was also one we did before that, a couple of years into the podcast, maybe our second year on our podcast. So in this clip, Peter talks about meeting Larry Scott. I think this was actually our first interview I did with Peter. So he talks about the reverence he had for Larry Scott and how he really looked up to him and how Larry Scott surprised him at the Masters Olympia several years ago. Here we go.
Larry Scott, I interviewed him 95 about his Olympia experiences. And then now and again, we do like a round robin thing, you know, ask so-and-so five bodybuilders about this aspect, you know.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm not sure we built up a relationship. I wasn't even sure that he knew who I was. But at the 2011 Masters in Florida, were you there?
No, I missed that.
Yeah. Well, he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, and the night before we had a press conference, and they announced that Larry would get the Lifetime Achievement Award, and asked him to say a few words. Now, this is one of the biggest shocks I've ever had. He stood up. He says, "Before I start, I'd like to give thanks to a guy who's done so much for bodybuilding." And he looked across at me, and I thought, he's not talking about me, because he doesn't know me, you know. He says, "There's an English guy who came here and really, you know, did great things, wrote great things, and I'd just like to walk across and shake his hand." And he did that. He shook my hand, and I was speechless.
Wow.
And some guy said to me afterwards, "But you never responded, you know, apart from that." I says, "I couldn't. I was too emotional." Larry Scott comes up to you and tells you, you know, is this a dream? He used to come into the office maybe twice a year, even though he lived in Utah, because he used to advertise in the magazine. So he'd come in with new artwork or whatever. So he'd say hello, but I never realized he even knew who I was, you know. But that was one of the, looking back, you know, it was certainly one of the most surprising moments, one of the most, you know, grateful moments that somebody, I mean, he's a legend, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
First Mr. Olympia.
Larry just seemed like just such a genuinely nice guy. Even when I remember when I was a kid and I used to read Muscle Builder, and he had the Ask Larry column in the back. And you could just tell by the way he answered a question. He was like, he seemed like really concerned and wanted to help everybody that wrote a question to him. He just seemed like such a nice person. It's a shame that the younger people today don't remember the impact Larry had, because I interviewed Roy Callender, and Roy was won Diamond Cup, and that was the last time he made his comeback in.
Yeah.
He was talking about that. He said Larry was in the show, and I said, "Oh, I forgot about that." And Roy said, "I didn't forget about it." He said, "That was like one of the greatest moments of my life." And he goes, "I went up to him backstage, and I told him what an honor it was to be on stage with him." Because Roy remembered what an impact, the impact Larry made back in the 60s, you know.
Yeah, it's funny when I, you know, when I got into looking at magazines in the 60s, this was even before Arnold and all those guys came in. You know, the real stars were Larry Scott, Reg Park, Dave Draper, Freddie Ortiz, you know. And I don't know why it is, I can't explain it. But because I was part of the sport when the other guys started to come through, I had no inhibitions about talking to Franco or Zane or, you know, but I was always in awe of Larry and Dave Draper and Red Spot. I never met Freddie Ortiz. I met the other three. And I remember Dave Draper came into the office, and then somebody came down to my office and said, "Dave's outside, you know, like to see you." And I thought, Dave Draper. I did tell his wife, Laurie, I don't know why it is, Reg Park, Dave, you know, Larry. There were still these images, these long ago images in the magazine, like gods, you know, whereas the other guys, I've seen them come through. So they didn't suddenly hit me as, wow, what's that? You know, the first time you saw Scott, he was complete, you know.
Yeah. There must be the ones we
we grow up idolizing when we're kids, and we never lose that idolization, right?
Yeah.
All right. And this clip, I think this is when I interviewed Peter about the NABBA Mr. Universe. We had a whole series of interviews. I can't remember what season it was. I think it might have been season 5, where we talked about the NABBA Universe. And Peter, of course, being from England, saw some of those early NABBA Universe competitions, like 1970 when Arnold won his last one, and then 1971 when Bill Pearl beat Reg Park and Sergio Oliva. So Peter starts off here talking about how he developed his newspaper, or his magazine, I guess you would call it, called The Pumping Press. And this is what got him the attention of Joe Weider. And this is what prompted Joe Weider to invite Peter to work for him and invited him to move to the United States to be eventually the editor-in-chief of Flex Magazine. So here is Peter McGough talking about Pumping Press and also about the NABBA Universe.
What happened was I'd worked for British magazines, and they did very well in the 80s, but then sort of mid-80s, 85, Flex brought out a UK edition, Muscle Mag did as well, and of course the British couldn't compete with 8-page spreads of Bob Paris and all the rest of it. So yeah, I had an idea that, you know, what was missing from the magazines was topical news, gossip, controversy. They tended to be a bit squeaky clean, you know, Flex. And we produced a bodybuilding tabloid. Now, what that did, that maximized on the gossip. But the great thing was it almost, I say it preceded the internet, because in those days, you could go to a contest in May, and then you wouldn't read about it in the magazines for a couple of months. You never saw anything. There was no iPhones and emails flying about, you know, showing photographs. But we, with the tabloid, we were able to, say, report the Mr. Olympia, for instance, the 1991 Mr. Olympia, on the Saturday it took place, and the following, 10 days later, it was on the shelves, on the newsagents. And people couldn't believe it. When the 1991 Olympians came to the post-European tour and we handed out the magazine with the full report, photographs and everything, they just couldn't believe how quickly it was. And it was quite a pugnacious magazine. You know, it was during the time of the WBF, World Bodybuilding Federation. And, you know, eventually caught Joe Weider. Ben Weider actually was the one who approached me first. I knew Ben better than Joe at that point. And here we are.
Yeah, that's great you say that, because, of course, you know, everything's different now with the internet. And you're right. I remember when I would read the magazines as a kid, the first thing I would go to, or the thing that I found most interesting, was the gossip. You know, I wanted to know who was training, you know, for what contest, or who was dating who, or what was going on, you know. So that was the most interesting part of any magazine, whether it was Muscle Mag or Weider's magazine or anybody.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I remember you told me a story that one of the guys who really freaked you out was Sergio Oliva at the 1971 Mr. Universe, the one in London, England, the professional Mr. Universe, the Bill Pearl one. So I was wondering if you could relate that story to us.
Well, you know, in those days, we used to go down to the NABBA Universe every year from our gym. We were a busload of us. And it was our, you got to remember, in those days, you only had magazines. There was no videos. You never saw these guys move unless you saw them on stage. You know, that you saw the statues move. So I'd been down the previous year, seen Arnold. He didn't enter in 71. Sergio was in, Bill Pearl was in, and Reg Park. And I'd seen all the photos of Sergio, you know, those massive round muscle bellies, a small bone structure.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't prepared for when he walked out. I just went back in my seat. And I've never really had that reaction since, you know. And it's just like he was second, but to me, he caught my eye, caught my imagination. And, you know, in those days, the competition wasn't like it is now. Dog eat dog, as it were, or whatever. We went down there for a celebration to see our stars. Oh, here's Frank Zane, here's Franco Colombo, here's, you know, Chris Dickerson later on. You saw all these guys, Arnold, saw them move. So it was a once-in-a-year event that we just used to celebrate.
Yeah, I don't think today's generation can understand that, but you're right. I mean, we only saw them in magazines. We only saw pictures. We never heard him talk. We never saw him move. And to see him in person was like seeing a movie star or a rock star, you know, because it was like, it was totally, it was so magical for us. I think that's why it was like the magical era.
Yeah, but it was absolutely, it was a special time, you know, that we'll never, I could go on about, you know, the pros and cons of the way things are presented now. Some things are better, some things are not so good, but, you know, you're in your 20s, you're living the life. It was a great time. You know, then we'd all rush back and start to emulate them, get in the gym the next morning, and you know, the place was packed.
Yeah, and the crowds were a lot louder too, right? I mean, I remember going to the Olympia in the late 70s, and the crowds were crazy.
Yeah, they used to go nuts when the guys, because, you know, you never saw them once a year. And the other thing that if you look at photos of that time, especially the 70s, everybody's dressed up to watch. There was none of this ragged T-shirts. And, you know, it was an event. It was an evening out, an afternoon out. You would wear a suit and a tie. And, you know, it really added to the whole atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to see Arnold, too, then, the year before in 1970?
Yeah. When, you know, he beat Reg Park, and I think Dave Draper was third, you know. Draper was in many ways, he was my favorite bodybuilder. He was the one that, when I started reading the magazines in the early 60s, he was the one that caught my imagination.
Yeah, a lot of people love Draper because he was featured a lot in Weider's magazine on the beach.
Yeah, it was the surf boy look, Californian, even though he came from New Jersey. And, in those days, it was like another, you know, nobody from England went to America in those days unless you were a Hollywood film star. There was never any dreams of actually ending up in California. And to think that I did end up talking to Dave and all these guys is just, I've had such a blessed life in that way. At that age, 20, I'd never imagined that I'd have the life and the career I've had.
Yeah. You just mentioned that I saw on Facebook, you said you think the best writer in bodybuilding is Dave Draper.
Yeah. He writes from the soul. He really gives you everything. And it's difficult to really open your soul and not embarrass yourself. Dave does that. Dave, he's still the same as he was back then. He was never in this for money or fame or glory. And even though he's got books out and got a business, you can still tell he's doing it because he loves what he's doing. He's not doing it to earn an extra buck. And he's a very genuine, humble guy. I just love aspects of him.
All right, another significant person in the bodybuilding world who died a couple of years ago was Bob Gruskin. And I think Bob passed away in 2020, and he touched a lot of people. He helped a lot of great bodybuilders when they were very young, when they were teenagers. He mentored them. He never charged them. He wasn't a coach to anybody, but he showed them how to pose. He showed them how to diet, and he really motivated them, and he really taught them to be good men as they were young men just getting into the sport. So we had a roundtable interview with Tom Terwilliger and John DeFendis and Jerry Scalise, and this part of our interview was the end of the interview where I asked these guys, what did Bob Gruskin mean to them? So first you'll hear from Tom Terwilliger and then John DeFendis and finally Jerry Scalise. Here we go.
The saying goes, you never know what you have until it's gone. And right. Honestly, I have a hard time even thinking about Bob and what he meant to me without like choking up a little bit and without a tear coming to my eye, because he was just such an incredible impact on my life. I mean, I didn't even realize it until he was gone, how much of an influence and how brilliant he was and how honored I should have been and still am today of him taking any even kind of remote interest in this punk ass kid from Massapequa, Long Island. Who was I? You know what I mean? And he saw something that I didn't even see in myself. And he helped me see that. He helped me begin to create a vision. He never practiced or utilized visualization, but he helped us create a vision of something more compelling than where we were, who we were at that moment. And that is absolutely invaluable. So Bob's, not only his influence, but his character, his mentorship, his training, has influenced almost everything. I mean, it goes so beyond the bodybuilding and the training and even the spirituality of it. It's just it's something that I'm honored and have really, truly been privileged to have Bob in my life, to have him interested in who I was and to help me become who I became. And he'll be missed. He'll be sorely missed.
What meant more to me than the pictures? And, you know, and I hope Stephanie Gruskin, his niece, gets a chance to see, you know, I know she's watched the other videos with her parents, Bob's brother. And I hope she gets to see this and really gets to see, get some insight on to see that her uncle was probably one of the greatest men who ever walked this earth and ever cared about anybody. The guy gave his heart and soul to every one of us. And what really got me with my file was I opened that file. And, you know, you don't remember back. This is going back over 40 years. And there were hundreds of letters. And I'm not joking when I say hundreds. Hundreds of letters and cards that I wrote to Bob over this span of time. And that span pretty much went from the 70s till pretty much the 90s. Because I was writing to him all the time. You know, this in the 70s, it was $5 a minute to call from Arizona to New York. So we didn't make long-distance calls. We wrote letters, you know. And we mailed those letters. And it took a week to get there, whatever, you know. But I sat down the other day and I read these letters and I was crying. I had tears in my eyes and this aching in my heart because every single letter I wrote just said, I can't believe how much you care and what you've done for me. And thank you, thank you, thank you. I have never read so many thank you letters. And I kept saying, you know, I have to win. I have to become Mr. America was my goal. Only you can help me get there. I know you can help me get there. And everything you've done has brought me to this point. And thank you, thank you, thank you. And the letters just expressed how important he was to me and how a lot of people didn't know this, but from training with Mihalik was a perfectionist. He was never good enough, and he made it where I was never good enough. He never, ever told me I was good. He never told me you've arrived or you've done this. All those years I trained with Mihalik, almost 6 years, and what I got from Mihalik was, you know, oh, do you think you're a bodybuilder? You're a fucking skeleton with a wig. You have no muscles. Look, you look like a coat hanger in that picture. That's what Mihalik would say. You know what? And people today, and, you know, I've had a lot of people tell me he was abusive, he was this, he was that. I said, no, that's the way it was, and he was telling me the way he had to tell me. But Bob was the guy that held me together. Steve was the guy that broke me down. Bob was the guy that built me up. And he didn't build you up in a false way. He didn't bullshit you, but he was never afraid to tell you when you did good or when you looked good or hang in there, hold it together, we'll get you there, don't worry about it. He was the voice of reason.
Yeah, and he was.
He was so, when he spoke, it would give you a peace, a calmness, knowing that it's all going to be okay, you're going to get there, and you're going to be in shape on that day of the show, and it's all going to work out. That's how Bob was, but he wouldn't bullshit you. He would tell you exactly, and as long as you listen to him, don't worry, just listen. You got to listen to what I'm telling you. Here's what you got to do, you know? But every letter that I wrote consistently said, I need you. You hold me together. You make me believe in myself that I can do this. And, you know, at times where I don't think I'm good enough, you give me the confidence to go on because Steve didn't do that. Steve played a part and a very important part. But if I didn't have Bob, I would have never, ever, ever, ever won the USA. And there were so many letters after the USA. It said that right in the letter. I would have never won that show without you. God put you on this planet to help all of us. And he did his job when it came to me. And he got me there. And he allowed me to accomplish my lifelong goal. And without Bob Gruskin, that wouldn't have happened. Absolutely no way that would have happened. And Bob, I'm sure you're looking down on us and you're going, well, you guys need to shut up. You need to stop talking about me, you know?
He doesn't want us
to talk about him. He doesn't. But I tell you, at the same time, I know he's feeling us right now, and he knows he did good, you know? And I hope that when he got I hope when he got up to the pearly gates, you know, God put his hand on him and said, you know, job well done. Well done, son. You did good, you know, and I know that's that, I know that's how it went.
Yeah.
I agree.
Jerry?
Well, Bob was like that angel on your shoulder. Whether you had a great day or you were in a dark place, he always assured you that everything was going to be all right. And it's funny, when Bob passed, the first one I called was my mom. My mom's 93. I actually called her at 10 at night and woke her up. Hmm. And, you know, I told her Bob passed, and she was upset because, I mean, Bob was part of my family. Hold on. sorry, guys.
You feel it. You feel it,
too. He was part of my family, and I used to pick him up on a Sunday and bring him out to Sunday dinner. He loved eating at my house, and I would bring him back to the Bronx. Sometimes he would stay a week, a weekend, and, it, you know, it's hard to replace someone like that. And he was just all our lives. He touched everybody. And, you know, like, I wouldn't be where I am without him. I mean, this man would be up at 11, 12 o'clock at night after you finished the gym. And he would say, come over, I have to take a look at you. And you'd drive up there. And he didn't have to do this. You know, he would open the door. He would feed you. It would be 12:30 at night. And like you said, he never wanted anything. And he's going to be missed. You know, just talking to him on the phone, like John said, he would ask you how you're doing. He would never tell you how he was doing.
Yeah.
And that's it. I can't really talk much more.
All right. And, of course, one of the greatest bodybuilders ever, Franco Colombo, passed away 2 years ago in 2020 also. And I think this took the whole bodybuilding world by surprise because nobody expected Franco to go. He wasn't sick or anything. He just had a heart attack when he was visiting Sardinia, and he passed away. So we had Jerry Branham on the show to do a Franco tribute. And Jerry told a lot of stories about Franco because, of course, he met Franco when he first came over to the United States back in 1969. So in this clip, Jerry talks about when he first met Franco in 1969, when he first came to the United States, and what Arnold told Jerry about Franco.
And a funny story, I can tell you how I first, Arnold first told me about, you know, I got to know Arnold, as you know, in past interviews, very, you know, I got friendly with him very, very soon after he came up to this country.
Right.
And I think it was just a couple of months after he was here, it was at Gold's Gym, and he came up to me and he said, do you know who Franco Colombo is? I said, I've seen him in the magazines, Arnold. I said, I think, didn't he win a Miss Universe or something like that? I know he's won a lot of titles in Europe. He said, yeah, he says, he's my good friend. We used to train in Munich together. He said, I want to bring him over here. So I said, gee, he looks like a really big guy like you, Arnold. And Arnold started laughing. He says, no, he's 5'4". And I thought Franco was this tall guy. I couldn't tell, you know?
Right.
I said, so that's incredible. I said, And then he said to me, he said, I'm going to get Joe, meaning Joe Weider, to bring him over. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, who shows up? There's Franco in the gym. Arnold told me about it. I knew he was coming, you know.
Did you get to meet him when he came over, Jerry?
I got to meet him. Unfortunately, I got a bad start with Franco. It's a funny story because what happens is they had a small dressing room at Gold's Gym, the original one, upstairs, very small. It had a shower there. Very small dressing area, no lockers. You just hung up your clothes on hangers. They had a bathroom and no door, you know. And, you know, Arnold used to sometimes practice his posing up there. And sometimes Franco would practice with him. So I was up there and I was changing into my gym clothes. And Arnold and Franco were posing, right? So I looked at Arnold. This is right before one of the Mr. Olympias, the early ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Arnold, Arnold, you look in great shape. You look fantastic. And Franco was posing next to him. But the thing is, I wasn't that impressed with Franco because his torso was tremendous. His back width was great.
Yeah.
I mean, he had great shoulders. But I felt his arms were too small. And he had – the best way to describe Franco to me, he had the torso – this is why I thought he was tall. He had the torso of a guy about 6'1", in his 5'4" body, and his arms were more for a short guy, and so were his leg. So to me, his symmetry was off.
Right.
And my thing, I always tell people, my big thing has always been symmetry.
Right.
Like when I judge physique contests, whether it's male or female, I always considered the whole body. Every muscle had to be in proportion and symmetrical. I didn't like the guys with just the big arms and you know, no pecs or big thighs and no calves. I vote them down because to me, you had to have a complete body. And I know you've always trained like that too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought Franco was fantastic in some ways. You know, his torso, his back, his pecs. But, you know, I just wasn't that impressed. So at the time, I think it was, 20 years old? You know, the brain doesn't fully mature until you're 26. So I blame it on my immaturity. I didn't compliment Franco. And he kind of looked at me funny. But I know it sounds weird. He never liked me after that.
Right.
He never spoke to me. He'd say hello. We'd talk. But it was almost like reluctant. He didn't even want to talk to me. Mm-hmm. He never forgot that. He took it as a personal slur.
Right.
I mean, I realize in retrospect I should have said something, but I was a kid. I just couldn't lie.
Yeah.
I just came out of my mouth. Arnold looked great to me. I wasn't that impressed by Franco, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, I'm not saying he wasn't a great bodybuilder or anything like that, of course, you know. I mean, like I say, I think I already told you the story in one of the past interviews about that pec thing. Remember about the pec thing where Frank, you had this weird cut.
Split.
You look in the photo. This right in his pecs on the top.
Yeah.
And Arnold came up to me one time. In fact, there was that same conversation when he told me Franco was coming. He said, you know that split that everybody's so impressed with Franco, that pec split he has? I said, yeah. I said, how did he get that, Arnold? I've never seen that in anybody. Arnold started laughing. He says, that's the funny part. He says, Franco had rickets, a vitamin D deficiency as a child.
Really?
And he has a malformation in the bones in his chest. And the way the muscle attaches, it created this kind of crevice he's always had. So as his pecs hypertrophied from training, it became more noticeable because his pecs got thicker. He says, all the bodybuilders trying to get that cut. He says, I'll be able to get it. I thought that was really hilarious. Wow. You know?
That's hilarious. That.
But if you ever see the photos, like, you know, when Franco's doing this kind of pose, you could see it. It was actually a bone deformation from having childhood rickets.
Wow, I never knew that.
You also see it in Franco's legs. If you look at some photos, he's slightly bow-legged.
Yeah.
And you see, and that also was from the rickets. If you look at children rickets, they always have that same look that Franco had, slightly bow-legged. That's, again, due to malformation of the bones from vitamin D deficiency.
Hmm.
Yeah, an interesting thing about him.
I think that's why he fell with the refrigerator, because they said his legs were bowed and he tried to run with it, you know, because he was moving pretty good compared to the other guys. And then he tried to run with it and then he fell and broke his leg.
And that makes perfect sense to me. I bet you that probably was related to it. I'm sure it was. And because, his knee came out on an angle and having that kind of pressure, you know, boom, you take one wrong step and there it goes.
Right.
Still, honestly, I felt really bad about, when I read about him dying, because, you know, it's like we're all in a brotherhood, John. You know, I mean, it's like a family, you know, when one of us dies, you know, and I'm not putting myself in the category of Franco, you know.
Yeah.
He was an incredible international champion, you know. What I'm saying is, as a bodybuilder, you kind of feel something towards him. You feel bad. It's like a family. I think a lot of people are feeling that now about Franco, you know.
Yeah, plus he comes from that old school bodybuilding that we all love. And, you know, we just had Ed Corney pass on the first of the year. And that was, you know, I felt really bad about that too. And same thing with Franco. I mean, I was kind of like depressed for a couple of days. I don't even really know Franco. I met him a couple of times, but I'm sure he didn't know me. But I just felt like you feel like you know him because we read about him for 40 years now, you know.
Yeah. Well, I had a delayed reaction myself. The first one was shock when I first read, heard that he passed away. And then as the hours went by, I got really sad.
Yeah.
Because think about exactly what you're saying. You know, Franco, Ed Corney, Serge Gnabry, a lot of the guys from the Pumping Iron movie, Serge Early. I mean, you know, they're all gone. And it reminds you of your own mortality. You know, you can't help thinking, well, how much time do I have? You know,
right.
I mean. You know, you can slip into depression. You have to snap at it really fast, which I had to do.
All right. And then, of course, Jerry, being Jerry Branham, has a lot of great stories. And in this great story, he tells about the time Arnold got into a fist fight at Gold's Gym and Franco was right there cheering his friend on.
A funny story about Franco is Arnold, it was again the original Gold's Gym. Arnold Franco were training there one night, and it was this kind of nutty guy, and you know, who fancied himself a boxer, right? And this boxer and Arnold got in an argument about, so stupid, the argument. I'll never forget it. It was about, you remember the bodybuilder Rick Wayne, you know, the famous body. The argument was about whether Rick Wayne took a lot of steroids. This boxer, who never even knew Rick Wayne, never even met him, was saying that Rick Wayne was all steroids. His whole physique was steroids. And Arnold was a good friend of Rick Wayne. And he says, no, he says, you know, Rick didn't hardly use that. He didn't use that much steroids. So, you know, the discussion got more and more heated. And I'm looking at this and I couldn't believe it. They started to get into a fight.
Really?
Right? And I remember, you know, the guy's trying to hit Arnold and Arnold's like ducking. And he lands a couple of punches on Arnold, and then he puts Arnold in a headlock. And in the meantime, Franco is standing there, and I'm living, and Franco's yelling out, "Kill him, Arnold! Kill him! Kill him!" Franco jump in. He doesn't try and help Arnold. He's just yelling, "Kill him, Arnold! Kill him!" And Arnold gets the guy in the headlock, and what I saw next absolutely stunned me. The guy bit Arnold. He bit Arnold as Arnold had him in the headlock, you know, he bites him, you know, and I think Dan Howard was the manager of Gold's that time. You know, he sees the ruckus, he runs over, breaks it up, right? He breaks up the fight. And so, you know, the guy's standing there, he's screaming how he's going to beat the hell out of Arnold. He says, I want you to show up in the boxing. They used to have a boxing gym, about a mile away in Santa Monica. He says, "You show up at the boxing gym, I'm going to beat the hell out of you with all your muscles. I'm going to knock you out, blah, blah, blah." So Arnold says in a very calm voice, he says, "Why wait?" He says, "Why don't we just go in the alley right now?" And sure enough, the guy just keeps on, instead of answering, he keeps yelling, walks away.
Right, right. He
basically chickened out because Arnold, let's go in the alley right now, and the guy want to go, you know. So luckily the bite that Arnold took was only Dan Howard broke it up faster, but Arnold wasn't really injured. He actually was a nutcase. Unfortunately, he died about within a year or two of a drug overdose. I think he was on drugs that night, and it made no sense.
I
remember thinking, even as a kid, I was looking, what a stupid reason to get in a fight with a Rick Wayne. You got to be kidding me.
Right.
You know? I mean, you could never get, if somebody said to me, you know, if I knew Rick Wayne well enough and they said, "Well, Rick Wayne," I'd say, "Well, he didn't." And the guy started yelling, I'd say, "Well, you're welcome to your opinion." I'd walk away. I'm not going to fight the guy. Believe me, what? I mean, if you don't even know the man, you want to say he took a lot of steroids.
Yeah.
Believe me, what? I mean, I can't change your beliefs, but it's not worth fighting over.
Yeah.
You know? But remember, Arnold didn't start the fight. This crazy guy did.
Yeah.
But I can still remember seeing Franco. It's like, "Kill him, Arnold, kill him!"
I thought you said Franco was going to jump in because he was a boxer. So
that's what I thought. I said, uh-oh. Because Franco was standing like a foot away. I'm thinking, if Franco jumps in, this guy's toast.
Right.
Because Franco, you know, this guy thinks he's a boxer. Franco really was a boxer.
Right.
And I saw Franco punch him. Franco still had the speed. He knew how to punch. This guy would have been knocked out, you know, even though this guy was about 6'2". It's about, you know, a little taller than Arnold. Franco would have knocked him out with probably one or two punches.
Yeah.
He's just lucky that Franco, you know, didn't jump. I guess he figured Arnold could handle him. Because Arnold told me when he was living in Germany, he used to get in a lot of bar fights. Franco was with him a couple of times, so I guess Franco figured that Arnold could handle himself.
Right. That's a great story. All right, one of our most popular interviews over the last 4 years was with Ellington Darden. Ellington Darden was an author. He's written several books, many, many books. I don't want to misquote him, but I think he's written at least 40 books. And he's written a lot about Nautilus and Arthur Jones, and he worked with Arthur Jones for many years. But Ellington was also a competitor himself. He started competing in the 60s. And so in this clip here, Ellington talks about how the AAU contests were run in the 1960s when they used to have the powerlifting or weightlifting first, followed by the bodybuilding. And then Ellington talks about meeting Boyer Coe when Boyer was only 17 years old. This is a really fascinating story.
Tell me about the shows back then, Ellington, because I heard all these stories about how the AAU used to hold contests back in the 60s. They used to do it after the weightlifting, and they would just have that one little light bulb hanging from, you know, you'd have to stand on the posing platform with the light bulb.
Yeah, most of these contests were held in a basketball court, usually in a YMCA-type setting.
Okay.
And you're right. They had a spotlight above hooked to the basketball goal. And you had to go out and do your posing that way. There would be 8 or 10 guys in the contest, and it was usually after a powerlifting meet. In Texas in 1964 through 1970, powerlifting was getting to be a major undertaking. And there were a lot of really good powerlifters in Dallas, which was 100 miles from Waco. So I frequently would go up and see them, and I got involved in powerlifting for 5 or 6 years too.
Okay.
And back then you'd do both. You'd enter the powerlifting contest, and then you'd compete in the bodybuilding show afterwards.
Oh, really? Okay.
A lot of people did. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do that?
Yeah, I did that. I won some powerlifting contest in the novice level.
Okay. Cool.
And that was the first. That's where I met Boyer Coe.
Okay.
Was in 1964 in Dallas. He was like 17, and he came down and entered the powerlifting contest as well as the physique. And I was sitting right by him as we were getting between our lifts, and I was pretty strong then. I could do about 320 or 25 pounds in a bench press.
Okay.
And here came this 17-year-old kid from Louisiana, and he could do like 385.
Wow.
You know, he was 3 or 4 years younger than me.
Wow.
And not very talkative, just very serious.
Uh-huh.
And, man, I just remember, John, sitting beside him looking at his triceps. They were just hanging down. You know, he's 17.
Jeez, 17 years old.
Every time he moved his arm, man, those muscles just rippled.
Wow.
And when they had the contest, the physique contest later that night, oh, man, he just exploded, you know, when he posed.
Yeah, that's the type of physique he had.
You know, I was telling somebody recently that I've been around a lot of big, strong bodybuilders, including Sergio Oliva, Dorian Yates, Larry Scott. But when I think back, the guy that impressed me the most was Boyer.
Wow.
At 17, because, gosh, you know, I would have given almost anything to look like he did at 17. And he was just soft-spoken. He never said much.
Right.
And, you know, later we became very good friends. And,
right. Did he win the contest that day, the bodybuilding show?
No, he got second to Charles Estes.
Okay.
The big 6'4" guy from Tennessee.
Wow.
Estes was about 25 or 26, and I think he got in the top five in the Miss America contest that year.
Okay.
Charles Estes, yeah. But next, the Mr. Texas contest, which was held about 6 months later, Boyer did win.
Wow, really?
1965 Mr. Texas.
And he was 17 then, 18 something?
I think he was 18, yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Texas was one of the few states in the 60s that you could come from outside and win the state contest.
Okay.
But nobody did that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the guys that came from New York or Alabama or New Mexico or Oklahoma, they were all Texas judges, and the Texas judges didn't like the fact that
he was from out of state.
He's out of state, so most of them didn't place.
Yeah, okay.
Well, Boyer came over there at age 18. He didn't know the rules.
Right.
But I'm telling you, John, he walked out on the stage and did a front double bicep, a side chest pose, and a back double bicep. And that was it. He walked off. But he brought the house down. I mean, everybody stood up and clapped. I mean, he won that show easily.
Wow. Isn't that amazing how good he was as a teenager?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've talked to him, and I talked to Boyer a couple times, and he talked about how he used to go to different states and compete when he was a teenager, and his dad would drive him to all these different places. So, yeah, he had a lot of success as a teenager.
Yeah, he had a dad. I remember seeing his dad multiple times. He was about 5'7" and weighed 140 pounds. He was
no kidding.
He was very lean, and I don't think his dad worked out at all. Yeah.
Yeah, he told me a story about when he found out he had that split in his bicep, and he showed his dad, and his dad said, "Let me see." And his dad went like this, and his dad had the split in the bicep too. Without even working out.
Yeah, well, Boyer was he was such a great guy. I still talk to him every once in a while on the phone, on the internet.
Uh-huh.
I think he's in California, and he's pretty close to 75 years old now. I'm 77. He's probably 73 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, another great guest we had on a couple of years ago was Mark Martinez. Now, Mark has been working, I think, since 2015 on a movie. It's a documentary about bodybuilding, and it's about the golden era of bodybuilding in the late 1970s, particularly the Gold's Gym, Venice Beach area. And Mark grew up, I think he's a little bit older than me. I think he grew up in the Southern California area, and he went to Gold's Gym in the late 70s. And he realized that nobody's really chronicled the history of Gold's Gym and Venice Beach area. So he took it upon himself to do this, and he's done many interviews with guys like Ken Sprague and Ken Waller and all the significant players in that era of 1970s. So we had Mark on several years ago to talk about it. And in this clip, Mark talks about Gold's Gym in 1977 when he went there to visit, and he met Rudy Humercilio and all the other great bodybuilders that he saw in their peak at Gold's Gym in 1977.
That first day, you know, Kent Keene's at the front desk, Pete Sammons at the front desk, Larry Gordon is there, Bill Grant, I'm trying to think who else, Tony Pearson.
Okay.
It was like, you know, and everyone says it, you know, the magazine came to life. It literally just came to life. And so I'm like, wow.
This was 77, Mark?
Yeah.
77, okay.
Yeah, and I could see that Rudy's, who I found out later was a stepdad, a gentleman named Dino, he could see that my friend and I are looking, like, you know, because our jaws probably. It was funny because my friend at the time, he was getting recruited to play football for University of Washington. So,
okay.
And he was a tall guy, you know, and he was a kid that could bench like 300 pounds as a freshman. And he was a pretty strong big guy.
Right.
And he would like look through the magazines like, these guys were all worms. Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
So it was kind of great to see his reaction because he was like speechless. We're just like, and I just kind of looked down like some worm, huh? And what was nice was that Rudy's stepdad, Dino, could see our interest. And so he called us over and said, you know what, he's done if you want to talk to him. And I got very, very lucky my first day because I never really had to pay my dues in that sense that because Rudy and Dino were very well liked, Rudy was almost like I wouldn't quite say a mascot, but he was definitely a very magnetic personality. Very handsome kid,
mm-hmm.
and people gravitated around him. And I think because he was so young and there was that innocence.
Yeah.
They were
good friends with Ken Sprague, who was the owner, and good friends with the manager. So all of a sudden, through my association with Dino and Rudy, I immediately got to know most, if not all, of the guys right off the bat.
Yeah.
You know, so I was just like, wow. Yeah. You know, it was quite a thrill.
Yeah, for sure.
In summertime, around contest time, it was like the magazine because everyone would come out, you know.
Just
amazing, you know.
So who did you see? Did you see Robbie and Mensur? Like, they were around at that time, right? That was their heyday.
Robbie, the first time I saw Robbie, and it was early morning, and he was training with a guy named Denny Malloy at the time.
I remember
him. Yeah, Denny was a very tall guy, got about 6'1", 6'2". But Robbie was unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, just unbelievable. You know, it looked like he had a 27-inch waist. Mm-hmm. When he would move, every single fiber in his body would just spring to life.
Wow.
And as you know, perfect shape.
Yeah.
Very, very intense and very, very quiet. And for me, you know, being like 17, I was kind of like intimidated. Like, it's like I could talk to Bill because Bill always had a smile.
Yeah.
Bill would include, you know, I mean, one time Jimmy and I are like, working arms and I'm doing preacher curls or something. And I hear a voice, come on, one more, two more, two more. And there's a little finger under the bar. And when I open my eyes, it's Bill Grant.
Wow.
You know, and I told Bill when I interviewed him, and I spoke to Bill about a month ago on the phone, but I said, you know, Bill, I go, your secret to life is you love people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Bill loves to train. I mean, there are some guys, as you know, that they go in there and they, you know, they, it's almost like they have to do it.
Yeah.
And to Bill, it's like, 5 a.m. squats, woohoo! He's just that guy, and not that Robbie loves to train, but Robbie would just, he would just go in the zone. But I loved watching him train because it would be moderately heavyweight for very high rep, which is something I'd never seen before.
Hmm.
You know,
was he wearing his torn up t-shirts, Mark, where he tied them up and stuff?
Oh yeah, it looked so freaky. You know, he had the. Kind of like the track shorts with those unbelievable hamstrings, and he'd have like the torn up tank tops, the beanie, the beanie on his head,
right.
And I you could rarely you would Rob you wouldn't even utter a peep, you know, he was just, you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah, just so in the zone, you know, watching those guys train. And then in the summer, my God, I remember Richard Baldwin, Dave Johns.
Yeah.
Manny.
What did you think of Dave Johns in person?
Dave was fantastic. And he was one of those physiques, and he was a very, very nice man. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, because he worked with troubled youth, and he was a corrections officer.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, so he was always a guy that he was just very, very friendly and helpful. And very strong. Very, very strong. And him and Danny Padilla, I think, kind of trained very, very similar. Like, they'd obviously had handled heavier weight in their past to get their size.
Yeah.
And then once they got what they felt was their size, then they would, I don't think it was nothing for Dave to rep out with 455 for squats, you know, for his working sets, and it looked like he could handle more.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't really followed professional bodybuilding since probably the middle 80s, but I would imagine, you know, guys back then, they're like, look, I'm not gonna add more size just for the sake of size. I want to make sure everything makes sense. Yeah, and John's, I mean, you know, when you looked at his physique, I mean, he's very, very balanced, you know, mm-hmm. Tremendous, really, really no weaknesses,
yeah.
You know, when you think about
right,
it.
Right, right, he didn't. No.
Yeah.
All right, that was great. And I guess Mark's documentary is about to come out. He has finally finished it,
and he's going to release it at the Venice Beach Film Festival, which I think will be this early October. I'm going to try to get out there because I would love to see it out there at the Venice Beach Film Festival. I talked to Mark because he just was interviewed by Dave Palumbo recently, so I'm going to try and get him back on the podcast to find out more details, and hopefully we can talk a little bit more about the movie. All right, this next clip is from one of my favorite guests, Boyer Coe, of course, a legendary bodybuilder, I believe a five-time Mr. Universe, one of the best pros competing in the Mr. Olympia and all the other pro shows in the late 70s and early 80s. So in this clip, we talked to Boyer about 1970, where he talks about competing in the NAVA Universe, where he won the short class in the pro division, and then Arnold won the tall class and the overall. And then the trip that they took with Boyer, Arnold, Franco, and Dave Draper, when they flew from London to Columbus, Ohio to compete in the AAU Mr. World that year.
I guess I won the short class. Arnold won the tall class. But what had happened that particular year, for some reason, I caught the flu on the flight over. And I threw up on the plane all the way over there. So I was dehydrated. So I wasn't feeling my best. But, I mean, Arnold was too good. He would have won anyway. I'm not saying that anything different. He dominated the contest. But you got to remember now, that was a great turning point in Arnold's career. That was a turning point. Because what happened, we competed one night, Saturday night, in the NAVA Universe. Okay. The very next night, we flew all the way back to Columbus, Ohio, and competed in that Mr. World contest that Jim Lund put on.
Yeah.
I mean, that was unique in itself because our flight was delayed. We finally got out of London, flew to New York. Okay. I to this day, I don't remember us ever clearing immigration, customs, or nothing. As soon as we got off the plane, because Lorimer had obviously the right connections, we were escorted to a private jet, and I guarantee you within 30 minutes, we were on our way to Columbus, Ohio in a Learjet. There was me, Arnold, Franco, and Dave Draper.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. So you guys left that night then, right after the Universe? No.
We didn't leave until Sunday morning.
Oh, Sunday morning. Okay.
Sunday morning, and I'm trying to tell, okay, we flew back, and at the weightlifting, everything was over with, and it kept delaying the start of the contest because we had never even arrived yet.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And so when we finally got to the hotel, the guy says, okay, y'all, you got about 30 minutes. Y'all got to be ready. So we just get there, we pack, change in it, and we're off to the auditorium there to compete in the contest. And I think that was something that totally mystified Sergio because he was expecting Arnold to be there, you know, and then from that point on, you know, Arnold basically dominated the sport.
Yeah. Did you think Arnold deserved to beat Sergio at that show, at the Mr. World?
From what I remember, yeah, probably so. But you see, then just a couple of weeks later, they held the Mr. Olympia, and Sergio was prepared. And I think Sergio probably deserved to beat Arnold, but Arnold already had the momentum, and that's how he ended up winning. And you also got to remember, for whatever reason, and I don't know how that worked out, I guess it's due to Jim Larmer's credit. That was the only contest that I remember that you had AAU people and IFV people all bunched together in one contest. Nobody complained about it.
Right.
No. Usually they would raise a big stink, but the Weeders didn't do it, and neither did, you see, Hoffman was still pretty powerful back in those days with the AAU. That was also the time, what was the guy's name? Alexei, the first guy that clean and jerked 500 pounds.
Vasily Alexeyev, yeah.
Yeah. The interesting story about him, I didn't see this happen, but I was told by a guy who did see it. He couldn't speak a word of English. Mm-hmm. And at that time, everybody stayed at that hotel right across the street from the state capitol in Columbus. Mm-hmm. So they said, okay, at a certain period of time, okay, you be standing outside of the hotel. We will have an interpreter meet you and, you know, drive you over to the contest to compete. So he understands that. So sure enough, he's standing outside of the hotel waiting. This lady comes along, and they told her that the interpreter would be a female. The lady comes along, and she's waving to a friend of hers on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He thinks the lady is waving at him. Mm-hmm. So he runs over, hops in her car. Okay, here you got a guy that's got to be around 6 foot five, 400 pounds, hops in her car. She takes one look at this guy, runs screaming down the street.
Oh, that's okay? Hilarious.
This guy doesn't know what the hell he's supposed to do. Here he is. He can't speak a word of English, and he just got in a car, and the lady jumps and runs away. So he finally got it straight, and, of course, he goes on to make history. But that must have been a sight. But a guy told me he had witnessed that.
That's hilarious. Well, that was a hell of a night, because Vasily Alexiev breaks the 500-pound record in the press. The Olympic record, and then Arnold beat Sergio for the first time, and was on ABC Wide World of Sports.
Yeah, that was an amazing time.
So in you go back to the Naval Universe in 72, and that was the one I was thinking of. That's where you won. You won in the pro division that year, and you got second to Frank in the short class.
Correct. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
How did Frank look that year?
Well, Frank looks like he always did. Frank is, I don't know how you can say it. He never had an exciting physique, mm-hmm. okay? But he always looked good, okay?
Yeah.
He looked polished, he looked finished, he looked classy. The best way I can describe it is give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
Frank looked good. He probably looked better than anybody just standing relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was just pleasing to look at. But now, again, just like Chris Dickerson, it was pleasing to look at. But when they posed, not a whole lot happened. It didn't change a lot. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, now look, take another example. You take Casey Viator, okay?
Yeah.
Casey Viator standing relaxed, just like me, you probably wouldn't even notice him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But when he started posing, it was a shock. The body, it exploded. And that's what caught people's attention. And I think Frank was very successful because he looked so good from all angles, standing relaxed. But when mm-hmm. standing next to him, he was never that big of a guy.
Yeah.
But once again, he was a guy that was always prepared, always had the best tan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but God, I mean, he used to lay out in the sun in Palm Springs for 7-8 at a time. He's very fortunate that you know, his skin has held up as good as it has.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to Wayne about that when we were talking about it, because you would see some of these guys show up really white and other guys would be tan. But back then, the only way you could get tan was to actually get a real tan, right?
You had to lay in the sun.
Yeah, they didn't have all these tanning products.
Well, let me go back to one thing, 1969. And okay. I hadn't brought this up. You know, I knew that Jim Haslip was going to compete. Mm-hmm. And I'd competed against him a number of times, so that was no surprise. But when I got to the contest, you know, naturally you're standing back there in a pump-up room, prejudged, and everybody's checking everybody else out to see who your competition is going to be. The one guy that I was concerned about was a guy by the name of Walter O'Malley. Hmm. I don't know if you were familiar with him.
I remember the name,
He was a big guy. Frank Richards was good. He was right there, too. He had a good physique.
Frank.
But Walter O'Malley, the best way I could describe him, he looked like, how can I say, it looked like a caricature that Frank Frazetta, I don't know if you're familiar with this illustrator, Frank Frazetta.
Yeah.
Frank Frazetta was unbelievable. He was the best. But he drew all the covers for, like, Tarzan and the Conan books.
Yeah. Okay.
Walter O'Malley looked like a caricature that Frank Frazetta had drawn for Tarzan. That's what it reminded me of. Hmm. The biggest, ruggedest looking guy there. Now, he was just like he was so white he looked like porcelain, you know, but he was from Manchester. But, I mean, I said, shit, this guy is going to be hard to beat.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, he wasn't professional in his presentation, but just a big, raw-boned, rugged-looking guy. And I remember Frank Richards telling me, he says, he likes to fight. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, we went out, and I don't know if this is an exaggeration or not. He says, he got in a fight somewhere. He knocked out 9 police officers one night. Wow. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's a pretty damn good story.
All right, and in this clip, Boyer talks about 1969 when he finally won the Mr. America after several years of trying, and then he flew over to London to compete in his first NABBA Mr. Universe, and he was successful. He won the amateur division there, beating out his rival, Jim Hayslop. So here we go.
We go next year. I'm fortunate enough to win in 69, okay? But what took place in 69 was far more important than the contest itself. Because what happened, the day before I had to leave to go, I'm working out with a guy in the gym, and he put some rosin on his hands, mm-hmm. you know, to get a better grip. Well, he's spotting me. I'm on the bench press. Some of this stuff comes off his hands and falls into my eye.
Mm.
Okay, so it starts bothering my eye, and I don't really take care of it. I'm trying to get ready to go to contest. So by the time I get to New York, I'm telling Dennis, I said, you know, I said, my eye's really bothering me. I still don't do nothing about it.
Right.
So we catch an overnight flight. We leave New York and we land in London, I guess, about 6:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. By the time I get to the hotel, I can't see out of my eye anymore. Thinking, my God, this, and it's swollen up.
Wow.
So I check into the hotel. I said, I got to do something. So I get a cab, and I told the cab driver, I said, look, can you take me to the nearest hospital? So we dropped me off, and luckily I found a doctor. He cleans my eye out, and yeah, I can see again. It feels good. But he says, okay, you got to wear this patch over your eye for 24. I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't want to look like a pirate. But so he puts his patch on my eye, so then I got to go back to the hotel. By that time, all the other competitors are there. So here's a guy who's the current Mr. America. And they think, hell, he's only got one eye, you know? So I said, oh, man. So then I became friends with some of the guys from England, like Frank Richards was a great guy.
Yeah,
Frank, great bodybuilder. Those guys were extremely friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So we go out this night, and the night before the contest, I said, well, look, let's go over to Wag Bennett's house. He's a party over there. Mm-hmm. So killing time, I go. So I keep running into things because I can't see good. I only got one eye. So I said, this is embarrassing. So I finally, I guess about midnight, took the eye patch off and threw it away. And then I could see all right. You know?
And it ended up working good because you won the contest. You won your class and you won the overall in your first NABBA Universe.
And the funny thing about that contest was, after the contest was over with, okay, so what you do, you go from the old Royal Hotel, which was really run-down hotel, but hell, you didn't care, you know. You go from, the coach would pick you up, bring you to the contest, and then bring you back to the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all I had on was my warm-up suit and my posing trunks and my little workout bag. So I didn't think to take any money with me. So the contest is over with, and I won, and I'm thrilled to death that I won. This is a great accomplishment. And I finally beat Jim Hayslip. After him beating me for 2 years, you know?
Right, you won the tall class, and you won the medium class.
Yeah, so, and then Franco won the short class.
Right.
So the guy told us, you know, after the contest is over, you go out of the stage door, and the bus will be parked, you know, a block down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking my time. I'm going out, and there's an old gentleman there. I guess it was kind of the manager. So I noticed when I went outside, I had all the streets blocked off. So I said, well, what's going on? I said, well, what's happened here? The guy says, oh, he says, everybody's waiting to see the new Mr. Universe winner. I said, you mean people are waiting to see people? I said, yeah. So then they all raise their hell, they would shake my hands. So I was overjoyed. I got so involved in that, the bus took off and left me, okay? And I didn't have any money, so I couldn't catch a cab.
Right.
So I had to walk all the way back from where the what the hell was the Prince Albert Hall, I think was back to the hotel. And I've always had a pretty good sense of direction, so I kind of figured out where the hotel was at. But it wouldn't have mattered. I could have walked back barefoot. It didn't make any difference to me.
Right. You're so happy.
Because I was so happy. So later that night, we all go out. We're going to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank Richard and a bunch of his buddies from England were in this bar. So Frank and I get up to go to the bar to order drinks for, there must have been 7 or 8 guys. So we're standing at the bar talking, and right next to Frank and I, but on Frank's side of the bar, were 2 lesbians, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, they get in this hellacious fight. They're fighting and throwing drinks everywhere, and they throw a drink all over Frank's suit, and he's pissed.
Okay?
So he immediately grabs one of them. Well, when he grabs one, okay, the second one turns on Frank, and she jumps on Frank's back, and she's clawing him all up. So I grab her and pull him off of him,
right.
And as I spin around, I see the strangest thing I have ever seen in my life until this day. I don't know if you've ever seen people who have, and I'm trying to think of the correct name. They call it a werewolf syndrome. It's called hypotrichosis. In other words, it's people where they grow hair for whatever reason all over the body. Their face and everything is covered. Everything. Mm-hmm. It looks like a werewolf. Okay, when I spin around and pull this girl off of Frank's back, this guy is standing right in front of me. Scares the living shit out of me. I'm thinking, my God, what the hell is going on? I thought it was a werewolf, you know?
It was Lon Chaney.
Well, what? This guy was the bouncer in the place.
Really?
He grabbed those 2 lesbians. He just smashes their heads together and drags them out of the place. So now he wasn't able to talk. He couldn't talk.
Really? Wow.
And he comes back in, and he made Frank and I understand. He wanted to thank us for breaking the thing up because they were just breaking glass. I told Frank, I said, you know, I think it's time for us to get the hell out of here. But that, and you know, it's funny, after I saw that, I thought about it for a long time. There's only 50 or so people in the world that have that rare condition.
Really? Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's very, very unusual. And this was happened to be one of them.
He was right there.
Oh, wow. God. I'm telling you, that was, like I said, the events leading up to and after the contest were much more eventful than the contest itself.
All right, and one of my funnest interviews I think that I did was when Tom Terwilliger and Joey Fulco got together and they started talking about bodybuilding in the 1970s. So Tom, of course, started competing as a teenager living in New York, and he went all the way on to win his pro card at the 1986 MPC Nationals, where he won the light heavyweight division, and then Tom was a professional bodybuilder for several years. Joey had a different kind of career. He was training at Steve Mihalik's Mr. America gym, and Joey went on to win the 1978 Teenage Mr. USA. But then after that, he stopped competing. And Joey is now a successful musician, and he has his whole family involved, including his daughter, who is a very, very talented singer. But in this clip, Joey and Tom talk about today's competitions and how it's changed from when they competed back in the 1970s.
Why did they lose the posing aspect? You don't see the classic. Look, half the show now, right? Forget about the competition. Half the show is showing what you've done. That's the whole thing. If you're not showing it, why are you fucking showing up at the competition?
Absolutely.
You're supposed to pose and have the thing. Is it just standing like a grunt? I mean, it's like they're sending a fucking photo.
Yeah, they're standing like a grunt and then like, okay, give it to me. No, show me something more than I just saw with the last 6 guys.
Right.
Show me a presentation that knocks me on my side. Show me a presentation that sends shivers up my spine. Like the first time I saw Ed Carney pose, I was like at Pumping Iron in New York City, the premiere Ed Carney pose, and I was just like, I got shivers up my spine. That presentation, that movie, literally, I was a 15-year-old kid heading in the wrong direction with the wrong bad self-esteem. I saw that movie and it changed everything.
That's
I saw
amazing.
Ed Carney and it made the decision in me
I want to move people like that. I want people to have that same reaction I have. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to explain why that has
disappeared. Well, I think they stopped judging the posing for the pros, and I think everything goes down, you know, like, because we were inspired, like you said.
Trickle down.
Yeah, you were inspired by Ed Corney. You were inspired by all the pros. And when we were teenagers, we looked at all the pros, and they were great posers.
Mm-hmm.
So we all wanted to be great posers. And now I think the pros, for the most part, are terrible posers.
I don't think they work on it at all. No, again, maybe because it's not part of the judging. I don't think there's any real effort put towards it at all.
No.
A couple of guys like Kai Green, there are a couple others. I hate to say that I don't know who they are, but I'm sure there's some that are really making the effort to make that happen.
But
since they took that away, that judging criteria, and it's work. I remember I've been complimented, you know, not to blow my own horn, I've been complimented several times on my 91 Olympia routine.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it may be one of the best routines in bodybuilding history, and I'm excited by that, that people still remember it.
Yeah.
There was a freaking lot of work, man.
Right.
I mean, I spent months putting it together, picking the music out, and you know, mastering it, man.
That was the mechanics of it, though. That was so part of the sport. Look, I call it a sport, right? Because it is a sport. So to me, that's part of it. It's like today when you see pitchers, they don't do the windup anymore. They just go right for like they're in the side. That's it. It's like, what happened to the finesse of let me show you? And even some of these competitions, it's a cattle call because they got 125 guys come in. None of them even get to show what they've done.
Nope.
That is so unfair and unreasonable to me. These people work hard. They paid their money. Their family came out. They all got hotels. They're in there. And they walk out and they walk off and say, okay, you didn't make it. Get the fuck out of here. I'm sorry, man. It pisses me off. I saw my daughter last year because I hadn't been to a bodybuilding show in 20 years. And I saw that, and I was like, well, isn't he going to pose? She's like, no, he just can't. I'm like, that's it? He broke his balls all this time dieting and killing himself for that?
Give the guy 30 seconds. Give him 30 seconds at least. Come on, his family's here.
Right.
Let him show a little bit. You know what I mean? Yes.
I agree.
Yeah, and the other thing that I don't like about today's sport, you know, is the when did this start? Yeah. When did we start standing like this? I mean, what is that? Is that even remotely aesthetic? Is that even remotely natural looking? I mean, look back to the guys like, you know, even the Olympia. You didn't see Samir Banoot standing like that. You didn't see Sergeant Bray. You didn't see Arnold. You didn't see Lee Haney. You didn't even see Dorian Yates, who was the gatekeeper of the next generation. You didn't see him standing like that. Bow-legged like I just got off the horse. Like somebody's holding her arms up with strings. I mean, what? I work with a young athlete today. You guys, good. I discourage that. You can't do it because everybody's doing it. I'm like, don't do that.
Your lats are too big. Come on, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
There's 6 feet between your arms and your lats. Your lats aren't that big.
Look, you guys both hit it on the head, and I got to tell you, man, I think of those. You could call it classic days or golden age. For me, it was golden age, and because I got to live it and be in it and be a part of it. I know the stories I have with Halleck and the insanity. As crazy as it was, I still believe it was a more romantic time for physique and bodybuilding.
Yeah.
And you knew the players. It seemed to have a different, like Robbie Robinson. I saw him training at Gold's Gym, and I was amazed. He was like a star.
Yes.
I don't see that today. And I'm not trying to diminish today at any stretch. But when I saw, like, even Lou and Sergio Nobre and Cal Skalczak and all these, my God. They were like rock stars.
Yeah.
But there he is. Oh, my God. Like, this skin had a different hue to it.
Yeah.
It was like more of this golden thing. I can't put my hands on it, but it seemed plastic-like. Like another world. I was so intrigued by, I want to be one of those. I still call it a muscle man. When I was a kid,
enamored.
I wanted to be a muscle man.
Yep, absolutely. I tell you, man, the first time I competed in the Olympia, but the first time at the Night of the Champions. And again, like I said, I think I was six that year. I was competing as Robbie Robinson, Bertel Fox.
Wow.
And I was like, dude, I was literally backstage. I'm like rolling up. I'm like, oh my God, freaking Bertel Fox, Robbie Robinson. I mean, literally, I'm looking around for somebody to put oil on my back. Robbie Robinson was the nearest guy. Freaking Robbie Robinson put oil on my back. I'm like, that was like, the contest was over. That's what I told my friend at dinner. I'm like, Robbie Robinson freaking put oil on my back, man. I mean, it was just like, these guys were stars. They were like, they were legends. You know what I mean? To compete with them, just even to see them was like, wow. Today, it's like, there's so many. Number one, there's so many. And they come and go. I mean, they look like monsters. And within a couple of years, they're gone.
You know, it's just like we don't really have a time to even follow them. They disappear. And then the next guy comes in, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a different world. It's not as romantic as it used to be. No question.
I can't believe you talk about being competing against those guys. That, to me, is such a cool accomplishment to say that. I mean, look, to be on the stage and in the back room with those guys. Because, you know, when we grew up, you talk about Night of the Champions and all those other shows. And legend. Robbie Robinson is a legend. I mean, you got to hang with him and level.
So it was so cool, man. Because I remember going to see one of the first Night of the Champions. Joe Nazario was competing in it, Robbie Robinson. Let's see, who else was there? Danny Padilla. Mike Mensur was competing. I think Mike Mensur might have won it. Dennis Tenorino. All these guys that I grew up watching and looking at and reading about in the magazines. I was like, oh, my God, I'm in the audience watching these guys. And then later on to compete against – now. Granted, Robbie was on the end of his career. So was Bertel Fox. Albert Beckles. My God. I was a teenager, and I went to see – Albert Beckles was the guest poser in some teenage contest in Connecticut. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he gave me his autograph and flexed his arm. I was like, oh, my God, it's freaking unbelievable. And here I am. I competed against Albert three times. He beat me twice. I beat him one time. And it was just like, freaking Albert Beckles, man. I was still like a 15-year-old kid, honestly. Yeah. It was like, it was amazing to me. It was a different time, no question, man.
All right, that was a great clip. I love Joey's passion where he talks about the romance of bodybuilding. I really resonated with that when he said that. All right, and now we're going to finish up again with one of my favorite guests, of course, Jerry Branum. And we did a 1969 in review episode. And in this episode, Jerry talks about when he got a chance to meet Bill Pearl in person. And I think this was in 1965 when Jerry was still a teenager.
I was friendly in the early 60s. I trained in Mid-City Gym. I was friendly with a guy who you have to really be hardcore to remember this guy. He was the editor-in-chief of Muscle and Fit. It was called Muscle Builder, not even Muscle and Fitness.
Right.
It's John Twitchell. Do you ever hear of a guy named John Twitchell?
Yeah, I think it sounds familiar. I never read any of his articles, though.
Yeah, he's a tall guy with glasses.
Okay.
And he trained at Mid-City Gym because we were still in New Jersey at that time, so he trained at the gym. I used to talk to him. I got friendly with him. I remember he used to wear the cutoff, sweatpants like Arnold would wear.
Yeah.
And he had calves. I remember I used to ask him, how'd you get those calves, man? He said, I was born with them. I remember him telling another guy with genetic calves.
Right, right.
But he was a very smart guy. You know, he wrote under another name, Carl something, I can't remember his pen name, because he did some stuff with Perry Rader, who had Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
But through my friendship with this guy, Twitchell, I got the addresses of all the top bodybuilders in the world, all of them, Larry Scott, Bill Pearl, Red Clark, all of them. So I was 14 years old, so I wrote to all of them, and I got to say, John, even back then, I didn't expect anything for free. And that's why I get annoyed about people today that always want stuff for free.
Yeah.
Because at 14, I remember what I wrote. I said, I would like if you could help me formulate a routine and diet. I want to get bigger muscles, this and that. I said, please tell me what you charge for this. That's what I said.
Yeah.
And I just got a little business card from Larry Scott. It was on Vince's Gym business card. And I think said something about $25 or something like that. I don't remember exactly the price. Everybody ignored me except Bill Pearl. Bill Pearl answered me, and I had a correspondence with him that went on for like 2 years.
Wow, that's great.
And when I finally met him, he came to New York in the mid-60s to pose at Dan Lurie's guest pose at one of Dan Lurie's contests. I remember it was at Hunter College in Manhattan. And I went backstage, I wanted to meet him. I was like really – you know, it's like these people, when people meet one of their movie stars.
Yeah,
I was really nervous. I said, because I idolized Bill Pearl. I had a Bill Pearl scrapbook.
Right.
Can you believe this? I used to collect pictures of Bill Pearl and put them in the scrapbook. He was my idol.
Right.
And he says, I had a chance to meet him. So I go backstage. I'm asking, where's Bill Pearl? Where's Bill Pearl? So somebody points to the staircase, and there's a guy standing in front of it, like guarding the staircase. Now, that guy turned out to be Leo Stern. I'm sure you remember him.
Yeah, his coach. Yeah.
Leo Stern was kind of a Bill Pearl's business partner. And also, Some of the great photos you see of Bill Pearl taken in that, you know, the really beautiful black and white, those are taken by Leo Stern, who had a gym.
He was a photographer.
In San Diego, that Bill Pearl trained at when he was in the Navy in the early 50s. Leo Stern himself was a bodybuilder who I think he got second or third in the Mr. America.
Yeah, I remember that.
1942 or something like that. I can't remember what year.
Right.
But so I go up to Leo Stern and I recognized him. I knew who he was. He didn't know me, of course. You know. So when I said, is Bill Pearl up there? He said, sorry, son, you can't go up there. I'm sorry. You know, Bill's getting ready to pose. He goes like that. I said, well, you know, I write to Bill. I think he would know me. He says, what's your name, kid? I said, I'm Jerry Brain. Oh, Jerry, you're Jerry. That's how he knew me. Wow. He said, go ahead, go up and say hello to Bill.
So that's cool.
I remember going up these dark stairs and behind the stage. It was like four flights up, real dark up the stairs. And I go in a room, and who's standing right in the middle? I'm just standing there. There's Bill Pearl.
Wow.
So I go up to him and I say, hey, Bill, I'm sorry to disturb you. I'm Jerry Brain. Jerry, oh, yeah. He says, and he goes, he says, yeah, you're the guy who writes it. He says, I thought you were about 30 years old. He says, I can't believe you're such a young guy. Because I was always a fairly good writer. It was like precocious. I started reading. I knew how to put words together, even at 14. So I didn't write like a kid. I wrote like an adult.
Right.
He was, and we had a nice little discussion. Great guy, friendly, you know. And I'll never forget that, though. That was I was so nervous to meet the guy. He was such a warm, nice guy, though, Bill.
Yeah.
He does that to everybody.
Yeah.
You know.
What year was that, Jerry?
What?
What year was that?
That would be around 65.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. How did he look?
He looked great.
Yeah.
He looked great. He posed. He brought, you know, the funny thing about Dan Lurie's contest back then in the 60s, he used to bring in a lot of guest posers, you know. Yeah. And sometimes he would bring in a guy just to give him an award, like he did with Steve Reeves.
Yeah.
Steve Reeves posed. He just gave him an award. And I was there for that, too. And I was in awe of that, too. I didn't actually meet Steve Reeves there, but I was right under the stage. I'm looking, and there he is, Hercules. Holy cow. Steve Reeves. And I said, he's still a handsome guy. He still looks like a, you know.
Movie
star,
yeah.
He was with his business suit. But, you know, the way the audiences were in New York, you probably heard this, you know, they were merciless.
Mm-hmm.
If you showed up to pose, whether you were in the contest or as a guest poser, if you were in good shape, you brought the house down. Larry Scott, 20-minute ovation when he won the Olympics. We talked about that.
Yeah.
There was one other guy, I can't remember his name. He was like a second-tier bodybuilder. He won a lot of shows in the 40s and early 50s. He also came out with a sword. I don't know what the deal with the sword was, but anyway. I mean, today they come out with one of those light lasers from Star Wars. This guy comes out and he's doing all this artistic posing with the sword, you know.
Right.
And I don't know why. He was in good shape. That's the funny thing. He wasn't out of shape. But for some reason, the things he was doing with the sword annoyed the crowd. And the audience got mad. And they started yelling things at the guy.
Right.
And I wish there was video cameras. This is hilarious. I'm going to forget. The guy takes the sword, picture this, and he slams it into the posing platform so it's standing upright. And he yells to the crowd, if you think you can do better, you come up here. I'm going to forget that.
Oh, God.
Happened there? The audience gave a standing ovation.
They liked it, right.
Oh, man, that would have been a great video. I'll never forget that. Hilarious. Yeah. That was so funny.
All right, and this is our final clip with Jerry and our final clip for the show. And this was about the another season we did about the 1965 Mr. Olympia, the very first Mr. Olympia. So I talked to a lot of people who were actually in attendance at that competition, including John Bailick, Roger Schwab, Dave Mastorakis, and Jerry was also in attendance because he was a teenager in Brooklyn, New York. I don't think he went to the 1965 Mr. Olympia, but he did go to the 1966 Mr. Olympia. And in this clip, he talks about meeting Sergio Oliva, who won the Mr. World contest that year in 1966. All right, now this next event I want to talk about was the Mr. World, and this was the one that Sergio Oliva won. So I want to get your thoughts on how Sergio looked. Now, this, of course, is back in 66, so it wasn't the Sergio that later won the Mr. Olympia, but that had to be amazing to see him, huh?
Right. Well, unfortunately, I have a bad story about Sergio Oliva at that particular contest. You know, Sergio Oliva, I, again, from reading the magazines, I was familiar with him. Mm-hmm. I knew that he was a Cuban immigrant that basically escaped Cuba by being on the Cuban weightlifting team. I believe they had a meet. I can't remember where it was, and he defected, and he wound up in Chicago. He trained with Bob Guida, who you know, mm-hmm. at the Duncan YMCA in Chicago, and he was in the magazines. He had competed in the AAU, and he had a couple of raw deals in the 65 AAU Mr. America. I don't know. John, you probably would remember better than me. I think he made the top five. He might have gotten sixth. But he was a phenomenal physique even then. And mm-hmm. he lost to a guy named Jerry Daniels.
Yeah.
No disrespect to Jerry Daniels. I mean, I never met the man. But, you know, if you look at photos of him, and I never saw him in person, to be, you know, to full disclosure, never saw him in person. But in the photos, he looked kind of like a swimmer with big arms. He didn't even look much like a bodybuilder. He had no leg development at all. And then you have Sergio. And Sergio got a couple of bad breaks in the AU. And this particular show that you're talking about, this was his defection to the IFBB.
Right.
He said, I'm tired of the bad, the bad placings I've gotten in the AAU. He suspected there was some sort of racial thing going on, you know, mm-hmm. and I'll leave that to others to debate. But this was his first show. So I knew of the guy. And, you know, he was a sensation. He was everybody was talking about Sergio Oliva. And I managed to get backstage, and there was Sergio Oliva. He was preparing to pump up for this Mr. World appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember he was wearing a butcher's robe that had blood all over it, blood stains all over it.
Wow, really?
Yeah, you know. So I went up to him. Again, I was 16 years old. I went up to him and I said, Mr. Oliva, can I get your autograph? I was getting everybody's autograph at the show. I was a kid, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if I should say a four-letter word here on the show. Okay, his exact response was, get the fuck out of my face.
Wow. God.
And I looked at him, and I know that in a recent show that you did about the NABBA universe, John, where you interviewed Peter McGuff and my good friend, Wayne Galash, who I've known for many years. You guys mentioned about, you know, what Sergio did a similar thing at when he competed against Bill Pearl with a young boy.
That's in 1971 universe,
Yeah, that seems to be his habit. So, you know, but the point is, getting back to it, I still had a kind of a Brooklyn attitude back then. I would react. You know, that's the way guys in Brooklyn were. We all thought we were tough guys, you know.
Right.
But I looked at this guy, I was about to curse him out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I looked at all the blood on the robe, and I looked at his face. You know, he wasn't bald back then. He had, I don't know what he was wearing, he had hair, but his face looked like it had scars all over it, like he'd been in fights. He reminded me of a pit bull that was, you know, a fighting pit bull with the scars all over the place.
Right.
And I immediately made the snap decision to quietly walk away and not say anything. And here's the funny part of the story was I told this when I met Sergio Oliva Jr. I told him the story, you know, and he laughed. And, you know, now, you know, Sergio Jr. is a good friend. He's, by the way, 360 degrees away, I should add.
He's nothing
like his father. He's a nice guy. Sergio's a wonderful person, friendly to everybody. He's not like his father was.
Right.
Sometimes Sergio, as a joke, will yell across the gym to me at Gold's Gym in Venice. He'll say, hey, Jerry, I say, what, Sergio? He'd say, get the fuck out of my face. That's like a standing joke we have, you know. But as I said to Sergio Jr., and I'll say it here, regardless of his personality, Sergio Oliva was a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was easily won the title that night. I mean, you know, he had that just ridiculously small waist.
Right.
Sergio Jr., I once commented to him, I said, you know, Sergio, you have a lot of your father's genetics. He says, yeah, but the one thing I don't have is that tiny waist he had. You know,
is that what he said? Yeah.
Yeah, he said that. And Sergio was just a phenomenal bodybuilder. He was, I mean, to this day, I mean, I still consider him one of the top three greatest of all time. There's no doubt.
Me too.
I didn't really him as a person because 35 years later or something like that, I was writing for Joe. I don't know if you remember, John. Do you remember when they had the celebration? I think it was the 30th anniversary of Mr. Olympia. Mm-hmm. Where Joe brought all the past Mr. Olympias on stage, you know, including Sergio, Arnold was there, all of them. And Sergio had a booth at that show. And I went up to him again. I remember he was selling a statue of himself in that famous, you know, that overhead pose where he brings his arms overhead. That was Sergio's signature pose, you know.
Right.
And he had a statue he was selling of him in that pose. And I went up to him. He's sitting there at a booth, and I said, "Sergio, you know, I'm Jerry Brain. I'm working for Joe Weider, and I'm interviewing all the Mr. Olympias who are here, and I'm just getting short comments from them. I said, I'd like to ask you for, you know, just a couple of comments." And he said to me, "You work for Joe Weider?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "It'll be $10,000." I said, "Listen, Sergio," I said, "you and I both know Joe Weider. You know he's not going to pay $10,000 for any interview." I said, and so then Sergio looked at me, and, you know, and I had to laugh. The first time it happened, I got mad. He said to me, "Then get the fuck out of my face."
No
said,
way.
Yeah, 30 years later,
oh
he had
God.
Changed. And again, when I told Sergio Jr. the story, he burst out laughing. He almost fell on the floor laughing. And my reaction when it happened was I didn't get, you know, Sergio was much less intimidating by that time. He was much older, and he wasn't as scary looking. So all I did is say, "Okay, Sergio," and I laughed, and I walked away. I didn't get mad at all. You know, I just I almost expected it, to be honest with you.
That's funny. All right, so that's it for our show, guys. I hope you really enjoyed this recap of our four-year anniversary. I hope you enjoyed all these clips that I put together over the last few weeks as much as I did. I really love going back over everything and hearing these great shows that we did. And hopefully we'll have some more great shows coming up in this next coming year before we get to our fifth-year anniversary. All right, I want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank again our Patreon donors who are so generously donating to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast each month by making contributions to the show. If anyone out there is interested in also becoming a Patreon donor, you can do that by going to their website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And you'll see it in the upper right-hand corner. There's a link to be a Patreon donor. All right. So I've got another magazine here. Also, if you guys have any ideas about what kind of articles you'd like to hear from these magazines that I have, just shoot me an email, naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll read those articles if you have any in particular. These old muscle builders I got from the late 70s have a lot of articles from Frank Zane, Mike Mentzer, Robbie Robinson, of course, Arnold. So if you're interested in hearing any of that stuff, shoot me an email, let me know, and I'll read it on the show. This issue I'm going to read from tonight, the muscle builder from February of 1979. They've got a lot of great articles in here, and there's a great 1978 Mr. Olympia report that I want to read. So maybe I'll read that next week. That was also written by Rick Wayne. So that has some great stuff in it. But this time on today's show, I'm going to read another article by Rick Wayne called "I Am Grateful to Joe Weider." And this is another Arnold interview that Rick seemed to do every year in the late 70s. So it starts out, while he says tongue-in-cheek that his success is due to loads of charisma, oodles of talent, good looks, Arnold found time to tell a Mr. Olympia audience, "I am grateful to Joe Weider," by Rick Wayne. July 1st, 1978. It has been a beautiful day, and now I am among some 2,000 or so hardy fans who have turned up at the Civic Auditorium in Santa Monica to witness AFAB's last stand in the face of the IFBB AAU affiliation. The show is late getting started, maybe because the promoters have decided to hold things up in order that muscle addicts caught in beach traffic might still get a chance to see the whole AAU Mr. USA contest. By 8:30, it is clear that everyone who is planning on being at the show is already seated and waiting impatiently for the affair to begin. At last, the curtains part, and Franco Colombo walks up to the microphone. Slight limps still discernible in his movement, a reminder of his recent accident with the refrigerator when it seemed his whole bodybuilding career had come to a sickening halt. "Good evening," says Franco in his own inimitable way. "I welcome everyone to the Mr. USA show, and I hope you have a great time. Now, I want to introduce two very funny guys who will MC for us, Cheech and Chong." Arnold Schwarzenegger and one of his girlfriends came in, took seats in the row ahead of me, just as the two comedians began their side-splitting, but totally out of place, Queer Wars routine. "Lately, we've been doing a lot of bodybuilding, meeting the guys at the various gyms and all that sort of thing," says Cheech, or was it Chong? "Like everyone else, we heard those dirty stories about bodybuilders being gay. But now we are here to tell you for a fact that it's..." For the next 30 minutes or so, the comedic pair went on to offer skits that were never meant for family audiences, certainly not the sort of family normally seen at bodybuilding shows. The greater part of the audience seemed embarrassed into silence, as if not certain whether to laugh or cry. Somehow the funny side of Cheech and Chong was competing with established bodybuilding mores. But Arnold Schwarzenegger was laughing so loudly, they must have heard his sound back there in Austria. When the comedians came on after a short break wearing rubber contraptions on their heads that must have been acquired from some Hollywood Boulevard sex emporium, Arnold practically fell on the floor. If what Cheech and Chong were serving was hip humor, then what an appetite Schwarzenegger has developed for the stuff. No double entendre, no pun passed over his head. He seemed to catch every Coke joke. My goodness, when the comics went into their Chicano and car routine, I thought I saw tears flowing down the big fellow's eyes. Never before had I seen Arnold enjoying himself as much. But it was altogether another story the next day. There we were at a meeting at World Gym in Santa Monica, called by Cal Scalak for the purpose of informing local professional bodybuilders of his plan to organize a union, ostensibly in the interest of a handful of people who actually make a living from the sport. Before the thing got underway, someone mentioned to Mr. USA that apparently had been a financial flop. "It's all Franco's fault," said Arnold. "The guy just refuses to listen to anyone. So cheap." Few of the 10 or so present at the union meeting understood what Arnold had said. After all, it is well known among bodybuilders that Schwarzenegger and Colombo stick together no matter what rains may pour upon them. In other words, if you are smart, you don't come between the two. But being the kind of persistent pest I am and always on the lookout for a story that might entertain muscle builder readers, I poked my poker into the little fire that Arnold's statement suggested to me. "Franco was most embarrassed by the comedians," I said. "He told me he'd never heard of them before, and he booked them only because his partner, Joe Gold, insisted on it." "Are you kidding?" Schwarzenegger had fallen for the bait. "We used to joke around together on Venice Beach. Franco knows all about Cheech and Chong, so don't let him fool you." Then, the meeting having officially started, I sat back to hear Arnold explain the purpose of the proposed union. From all I heard, it seemed the whole idea had come from Scalak, but Arnold admitted he had been most supportive of it. Indeed, he had volunteered his services as treasurer. At one point, he chose to explain his position. "I've taken on this particular responsibility," he said in impeccable, if slightly accented English, "because I will be the person chiefly responsible for raising funds for the union." The meeting broke up after about an hour, with Scalak promising to bring the pro bodybuilders together for another conference the day after the 1978 Mr. Olympia. For Cal. In the days that followed, one read various things purportedly written by Arnold for another magazine and suggesting the bond between Weider and the 6 times winner of the Mr. Olympia Award had been broken. Indeed, when Muscle Builder carried an article entitled "Thanks is Not a Four-Letter Word," thousands believed the article was aimed specifically at Arnold, even though it pointed to a host of people who ought to be grateful to their benefactors, simply because it is human to show gratitude in the face of good deeds. The published feature brought in numerous letters, and for a while it seemed a cold war had developed between Muscle Builder and our number one bodybuilding ambassador. Then came the July 29th World Cup contest, followed by a special IFBB meeting called by the president of the group, Ben Weider, a day later. Among the pro bodymen present was Arnold Schwarzenegger and Cal Scalak. Officially, the meeting had convened so that Ben might listen to various gripes from the professionals in advance of the 1978 IFBB Congress to be held in Acapulco, Mexico in November. But as far as most of those present were concerned, this was to be the big showdown. Many believe Ben was so annoyed about the Scalak-Schwarzenegger union move, he had organized his meeting only to deal with that matter. But the president of the IFBB would dispel all such rumors with his opening remarks. "For a long time, Rick Wayne, our editor, has been asking me to call a meeting of California's professional bodybuilders so as to hear some of the problems facing you. Well, here's your opportunity to clear the air. Please speak your mind. The IFBB is a democratic body. Feel free to say whatever you have in mind without fear of recriminations. After all, we are all friends and with a common interest." Arnold Schwarzenegger was sitting in the front row, inches from where Ben Weider and Oscar State were conducting the proceedings. Next to Arnold was Bill Pearl. Joe Weider sat 2 rows back. On Joe's left, separated by an aisle, Cal Scalak had taken his position. For a while, they talked about physique competition, judging, prize money, everything but what most of those present had turned out to hear. But then Bill Grant suddenly asked the question, what about the bodybuilders' union? That was the start. Ben wanted to know why such a group was required. Scalak told him bodybuilders were being ripped off by callous promoters, and since the IFBB obviously had its hands full, it was only right that a watchdog group should look after the interests of pro bodybuilders. For nearly 15 minutes, Ben and Cal went for each other, Ben getting most of the support, if not all of it. At one point, Arnold claimed he had been badly treated by a promoter in Mexico, which apparently was his main reason for backing Scalak's move. There was no wild exchange between Arnold and Ben, however. Poor Scalak, it seemed all the arrows, and there were many in this obviously pro-IFBB gathering, came his way. Schwarzenegger has the makings of a top-flight diplomat, and it showed. He offered very little that might have been construed as pro-union talk. That he left to Cal. Shortly before the meeting ended, disastrously for the would-be unionist, Arnold walked over to Ben Weider's table, put his arm around the IFBB president, whispered something in his ear, and left. If anyone seriously thought Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Weiders were on the verge of breaking up, well, here was cause to think again. Later, Ben Weider would say there was never any trouble between his organization and Arnold, that Arnold is free to make all sorts of suggestions. It is a free country. He left no doubt at all that Schwarzenegger was still considered a friend of the IFBB. He has contracted to run both the 1978 and 1979 Mr. Olympia contest, Ben assured me. The Olympia is the biggest IFBB show, and Arnold will be running it with his partner, Jim Lorimer. Are we friends? Certainly. And that, as they say, was that. The next time we saw Arnold Schwarzenegger, he was holding forth at George Snyder's IFBB Mr. Eastern United States. Minutes before he came on stage, the packed auditorium had been treated to some footage from Pumping Iron. Arnold's appearance on the screen was all the excuse the audience needed to misbehave. They whistled, screamed, shouted, applauded. Whatever Star Wars had ensued in California, the fans remained loyal to bodybuilding's retired number one. The film ended, but just as the fans were settling down in their seats, the MC triggered off another explosion. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "you have seen the greatest bodybuilder of all time on the screen. Now it gives me great pleasure on behalf of George Snyder and the IFBB to present in person Arnold Schwarzenegger." And indeed, the spotlight picked him out standing stage right, relatively slim in casual slacks and sports shirt. No ovation Arnold received throughout his career could have equaled the reaction to this Pennsylvania appearance. For a full 5 minutes, everything was held up while the fans let Arnold know exactly how they felt about him. Love had never showed up more boisterously. At last, they sat down to hear him conduct what had been advertised as a seminar, but turned out to be an intimate question and answer period. There were all kinds of queries. What do you think of Mike Mentzer's system of training? When are you making another movie? What do you say about anabolics? Do you believe in running? One got into the swing of things with one's own question. Will we ever see you in competition again? I had asked him this question many times before, at his home in Santa Monica, during interviews at my office, anytime I got the opportunity. He looked at me from his place high on the stage of the William Tennant Senior High, smiled knowingly, as if to say, "So, you think you'll catch me off guard in this atmosphere, huh?" "No," he said, in answer to my question, "I will never return to competition. I am far too busy with my acting career, running the Olympia, turning out my books, and so on. I'm satisfied with all I've done in contests." The day after, at breakfast at the Snyders, Arnold turned up with his girlfriend of the day, Maria Shriver, with the Kennedy connections. He was attired in sweatpants, t-shirt, and running shoes, all set off to go on a 3-mile jog. It seems jogging and stretching make up the largest part of Arnold's bodybuilding program these days, which accounts for his somewhat slimmer lines. I left for Canada shortly after breakfast, having arranged to meet with Arnold again when we both returned home to Los Angeles. It was 3 weeks before I received his call. "Ricky," he said in that usual sing-song fashion of his, "why don't you come over this evening? We can have dinner together and then we'll talk a bit." "Okay," I said, completely forgetting Roots would be on television. I'd missed the program the first time around. I was in the Caribbean at the time plugging my book, It'll Be All Right, and had been looking forward to its second coming. 30 minutes after agreeing to meet him. "Hey, Arnold," I said, "why don't we postpone the interview? I can't come out this evening." "Sure you can." "No, I really can't. We agreed to meet earlier." He had moved into a huge building on Ashland in Venice. Oh, he still maintained his place on Wilshire, but that was strictly for private purposes. Now he had acquired a new address, plush, gleaming, superbly manicured. You stepped on red carpet the minute you entered the building and did not get off the sanguine thing, even when you had to visit the bathroom. "How long have you been in this new place?" I wanted to know. "Oh, I bought it over a year ago. We've been doing it up ever since." The way he said it, you'd think he was talking about a barbell or a cat or anything other than this amazing piece of expensive real estate. Everywhere you looked, there was luxury written in capital letters. The bathroom had obviously cost a lot in decorative, functional contraptions. The light switches were from the very latest catalogs. Telephones all over the place. On his huge desk, the various toilets on glass tables. Hollywood-oriented magazines lay on special stands. Paintings from Germany, France, Russia hung on the walls, and the telephone tinkled incessantly. It's easy for the American bodybuilder, who has more or less always known Arnold Schwarzenegger as a star, to accept his new environment. Indeed, the average American visitor expects the sort of things with which Arnold currently surrounds himself. Ah, but there was a time when the guy could hardly understand a word of the best English, when he had no idea where his next protein pill would come from, when he was just a bloated kid with air in his pockets. Times certainly have changed. Today, Arnold is the author of two best-selling books, has weathered seemingly 1,000 talk shows, has traveled the world 2 or 3 times, met heads of state in practically every spot on earth, and he is still moving upwards. And on the wonder of it all, the miracle of the thing, is how unchanged Arnold has remained throughout. His dress is most often casual. He seems to favor moccasins, slacks, and sports shirts. Nothing ostentatious. He still wears a single ring on his right hand and a not all that conspicuous watch on his left wrist. No gold chains. True, he can afford to go skiing with the Kennedys, and once in a while you'll hear him say something about Jackie, and you'll guess he's talking about the former First Lady. But in no way does he make it sound like name-dropping. Sometimes he'll wink at me when he says it, his way of reminding me of the old days when we knew Odile. Ah, but that's a very private matter. When America was merely a dream to be achieved by the very fortunate. Schwarzenegger's come a long way, and somehow you feel happy for him. So we are sitting on either sides of his massive desk that evening and talking about the old days. "Whatever happened to Franz Dischlinger?" I ask after a while. "Oh, I haven't heard from Franz in a long time. I think he moved from Germany to France. He was studying. The two used to be very close. Will you be going on to Europe after the Olympia this year again?" "Not this time, unfortunately. I've got to practice my horseback riding for my movie with Anne Margaret and Kirk Douglas. Then there are the clothes-fitting sessions with the movie people. I guess I'll be tied up until December." "What's it called?" "The Villain. And I play a straight role. Nothing to do with muscles. It's a comedy." "How's a new book coming along, the one on training for women?" "We've just handed that over to the publishers. It'll be out in 1979. Soon we were talking about competition again. I can't see how I could find time to return to competitive bodybuilding. There are other more important things to do. After all, why return to old ground when there's so much new territory to discover? Wouldn't a return, a successful return to the Olympia platform, benefit Conan the Barbarian?" "Now that's a point. Certainly it would create fantastic interest in the movie, but I'll have to wait and see. We should begin filming it soon." Suddenly a thought occurs to me. "You took the Mr. Olympia title 6 times in a row, Arnold," I say. "Why was it so important to enter year after year?" He looked at me, smiled, revealed the Ernest Borgnine gap in his front teeth. "You know, I never thought about it. It was just something one did every year. You knew you had to be in shape to take on the monsters, and I did. Do you think you'll return?" "I won't give up." "Joe Weider thinks you will in 2 years' time." He roars as only Schwarzenegger can. "That Joe, he's always planting ideas in someone's head. He was here last night and he suggested I ought to come back. But who knows?" "Don't you miss it? Competition, I mean?" "Not really. After all, I'm right there at the Olympia every year. I promote the darn thing. I get a great kick out of it." "How much work's involved in putting on the show?" "We start getting things together the day after the show, in readiness for the next. 2 months after the contest is over, we write to our regular supporters offering them first choice of seats at the next. Then there are all the arrangements to be made with competitors, judges, and so on, hotel accommodations, travel tickets, that sort of thing. Of course, we have a great team, Jim Lorimer and me. The whole thing goes like clockwork in the end. There's one question I've been itching to ask Arnold. The time was ripe for putting it to him. Why did you refuse to get up there against Sergio Oliva, you know, at the Mr. International in Mexico when he challenged you? Oh, that, he smiled. So much has been written about that one, I think it might be right to clear it up once and for all. I was in shape. I think it was 2 weeks before the year's Mr. Olympia, which was being staged in New York. You must remember, I had already beaten Sergio 2 or 3 times. Well, I've been asked to compete in the Mr. International against him. Eddie Sylvester, the promoter of the Mr. International, had written asking me to go up against Sergio. I told him the idea was stupid. I had already won the international title. Hell, I was Mr. Olympia twice already. Besides, I thought it would be better to wait for Sergio to show up in New York. Well, I go to Mexico with Joe Weider, and we're sitting there watching Sergio collect his trophies, and suddenly somebody says Sergio wants to challenge me. Sergio starts shouting all sorts of things from the stage, and the people in the audience who had been led to believe I would go up against Sergio started acting up. It was a silly scene. I think Sylvester's brother was behind the whole thing. He was supposed to be making a movie with Sergio at the time. A bad scene. Can you imagine Muhammad Ali at a Foreman-Frazier fight, and just because the winner says, I want Ali, Ali's handlers push him into the ring? Nonsense. So I refused to go up against Sergio with that circus. He didn't show up at the Olympia, unfortunately. But he did in Germany. Yeah, he did. He was really in fantastic shape. I looked at him, and I knew I'd have to do everything to beat him that time. You know, Sergio has never really believed he deserved to be the world's greatest bodybuilder. No matter that everyone else might be telling him he's number one, he never believed it. So there he was in Germany in top form, but his head wasn't right. I knew that. I was not at my best, but I looked bigger and heavier than Sergio. I looked around and I saw the background against which we were posing was dark. It occurred to me that Sergio would not look at his best against such a backdrop. His skin is dark, after all. Score 1 point for me. And then you know Sergio has never been a great poser. Score again for me. And finally, every time we posed together, I moved up a couple of feet closer to the judges so that I appeared even larger. From the corner of my eye, I could see Sergio involved with himself to the extent that he never even looked at me. He kept his head down when he should have been up. His legs were never properly positioned. He looked a mess when he was without a doubt in the greatest shape of his life. It just goes to show that you don't win just because you got a great body. You win because you know how to display it so that it impresses the judges. That's the reason behind Frank Zane's many victories against guys who were bigger and more muscular. At dinner later, we talked about more personal things. When are you going to get married? I inquired. He changed the subject. Do you see yourself getting into politics? What kind of politics? I'm already into that. Bodybuilding politics. Again, he changed the subject. What kind of woman do you go for? I persisted. Female. No, seriously. I don't go for a woman just because she has a nice body. Anybody can build a nice body if she wants to. And if she doesn't know how, hell, I can teach her. All I need from her is the desire to improve herself. There are certain things that can never change, however. A woman who is insanely jealous will never change. A woman who thinks she's a man will always be that way. She'll cause no end of trouble in a marriage with a real man. I watch out for such things. The scene, the Veterans Memorial Auditorium, late September. The 1978 Mr. International contest is over. The prejudging has just ended. Someone brings Oscar State to the microphone to say a few words regarding the night's program. Oscar announces a short intermission, says the Mr. Olympia contest will be prejudged soon afterwards, but the fans refuse to leave the auditorium. Arnold, 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 they begin to chant. We want Arnold. Arnold is backstage conducting what appears to be choreographed madness, with muscle men all over the place, all with a million questions for him. Arnold, Arnold, Arnold. It is clear the folks won't give up until the man shows up on stage. So he does. I want to say thank you for turning up in such large numbers. Thank you very much for your support. I'm very busy backstage, but I promise I will be out there in the foyer in 15 minutes to sign all the posters and t-shirts and whatever else you may have brought from the sales girls. I'll see you later. Did anyone ever witness such unadulterated nerve? It's like Ali haranguing the press. They love it. The masochists crave it. The Mr. Olympia International 1978 turns out, predictably, to be the best ever. From a measly $1,000 in 1965, the prize money has risen to nearly $30,000 for Mr. Olympia competitors. It's a great night for all of bodybuilding. At one point, Arnold came on to deliver a speech. And I want to say that even though I sometimes quarrel with Ben and Joe Weider and the IFBB, I remain very loyal to them. They've done a lot for me in bodybuilding, and I am grateful. Arnold, if he ever takes it into his head to swim in the cesspool of party politics, will make one hell of a contender. Bodybuilding has provided him with much opportunity for practice. Well, now it's been 2 weeks since the Mr. Olympia in 1978, and at last Arnold has returned to home base. Indeed, I corner him at the Weider building in Woodland Hills for a minute or two, time enough to ask his feelings on the results of the contest. To the point, as always, he says, I have no quarrel with the number one winner. Zane was perfect. He deserved to win. But from there on down, I think it was a mess. And I believe two AAU judges had a lot to do with it. They never placed Boyer Coe, even though many thought Boyer was good enough to win. They placed Danny Padilla, who was not in shape, over Ed Corning. I couldn't see that way at all. I thought Dennis Tenorino should also place the money. It had been agreed a day before the contest that we had about 13 or 14 people out of whom we choose judges for the International and the Olympia. We didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings, so we decided some judge one contest and the rest would judge the other. I felt we should have the muscle stars, guys like Bill Pearl, Larry Scott, Winston Roberts, Leroy Colburn, and Paul Graham judging the Mr. Olympia. To those, we added other experienced IFBB judges for a total of 7. We considered allowing Jim Mannion to judge, but a number of the competitors were against that for reasons I don't wish to go into here. So Ben Weider suggested we should show Mannion respect since he's the chairman of the AAU Physique Committee. Ben said we ought to let Mannion pick 2 AAU judges to sit on the Mr. International and Mr. Olympia panels. The agreement was reached in the presence of Dennis Stallard and Oscar State of the IFBB. But on the day of the contest, the AAU people told us they wanted nothing to do with the international event. They were interested only in judging the Mr. Olympia. Ben reminded them of our agreement, but they insisted on judging only the Mr. Olympia. The AAU guys didn't come out to help bodybuilding. They were there to satisfy their egos. They actually voted Danny Padilla over Zane in a couple of the rounds. In the overall, however, they put Danny behind Zane, as if they realized in the last analysis that they had been ridiculous putting him ahead of Zane in the first place. They placed Boyer nowhere. It was so obvious that the 2 AAU judges favored the contestants from Gold's Gym, intentionally or otherwise. I'm glad Zane won, because I think he was the best on the day of the Olympia. Had he lost because of the AAU judges, I'd have done my best to have the contest properly judged a second time. It's not that I'm against having AAU judges in my contest, but they should be fair and straight. There were one or two other small problems, like the one with Bill Grant over hotel and travel arrangements. Says Arnold, by the spring, I had sent out all the invitations to the various competitors in the 2 contests. I remember Bill gave me his address at my birthday party in the summer. I sent him another invitation to the contest. There was no reply. In the beginning of September, way past the entry deadline, Bill told me that he was interested in competing and he would notify me in writing. Of course, there was no such letter. Then a week or so before the Olympia, I received a 2-line letter from him. I'd allowed him to compete, even if he'd not written at all. But because we had no official notification from Bill until that late date, we could not make hotel reservations on his behalf. The trouble over his ticket was of his own making. We made out tickets to him because he was the one competing in the Olympia, not his girlfriend. But because we wished to cooperate, the ticket was made out so that he could put in whatever name he wished. Only our record showed it was made out to Bill Grant for accounting purposes, you understand. From what I've learned, Bill had no trouble rearranging his ticket, so I don't know why he's been griping. Many people think Bill's only trouble is with his calves. Obviously, that's not so. My final question. What is it about the Mr. Olympia contest that makes it magical? The same people appear in other events, but the atmosphere is never the same. A number of things are responsible for the Olympia atmosphere. First, you have to give thanks to Ben and Joe. Through the magazine, they've helped build up the contest as the greatest of all bodybuilding events. Then there's the element of surprise. We did not advertise Reg Park that time he guest posed at the contest. We made no big thing about Pearl and Scott, but there they were at our last show. The fans know that they'll get everything we advertise plus surprises. We don't say we'll give this or that prize and then not keep our word like some other promoters. The movie people account for much of Arnold's time these days. Our interview over, he said he had to rush off for yet another lesson in horseback riding in preparation for his latest role. Why you, I finally asked. Of all the top bodybuilders born and bred in America, why you? You mean the success? The gleam was in his eye again, the mischievous gleam. Well, he said, with only a soupcon of a put-on smile, it has a lot to do with talent, humility, charisma, not forgetting the God-given good looks, of course. Of course. And that ticket from Joe Weider in 1968. All right. That's a great article by Rick Wayne about 1978 Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it's interesting that Rick kept asking about competing again, and Arnold kept denying it. And then Rick even brought up, well, wouldn't it be great promotion for Conan the Barbarian? And Arnold said, yeah, that's a good idea. And that's exactly what happened 2 years later. And it was also interesting, as I read this again, that Joe Weider predicted Arnold would come back in 2 years, which would have been 1980. Very, very interesting stuff. All right, that's it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed this recap of our fourth year anniversary and all these old shows. We will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Stay healthy, enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.